very pleased to see so many people back here again. Sometimes it happens that when people start meditation, sometimes there are difficulties, especially the first day. And it's very good that you have enough confidence that by staying the course, one can usually overcome those obstacles and to enjoy the peace of meditation. Especially that many of you are meditating for the first time, and it's not an easy thing to get one's mind around the way of peace. Because very often that the way of meditation goes against the grain. As the Buddha would say, it goes against the stream of craving. It goes against the usual way we do things in life. When you were small and went to school, you realized if you wanted to have any success in life, you had to work hard for it. You had to strive and keep on going. Some of those qualities are useful in meditation, but some are not helpful at all. In the world, we want to try and get somewhere. In meditation, we want to be where we already are. We don't look at progress, we look at ingress, and going inwards, being more still. And that path of going inwards instead of onwards, to going inside instead of going outside, is the heart of what meditation is all about. To go into the center of things, to go into the heart of things, to go into the truth of things. Because the heart of things, the truth of things, is the essential meaning of the word Dhamma. Where all this comes from. The why, the where from. Not the where to, but the where from. And because of that, there's a word in Pali which I've often focused on, which is very often mistranslated in the sutras. Many of you know that word. If you read the translations of the Buddha's words, you probably hear that as wise attention. The word is yonisomanasikara, and it's such an important word that it's one of the two causes for the attainment of stream-winning of soul-one. Yonisomanasikara. But the root meaning of that word, of yoniso, I'm sure that in Sinhala you have a similar word for the womb or the origin, yoni. I'm not quite sure what the Sinhala word is for that, but in Pali, the word yoni means the womb, the source, the origin of things. And literally, yonisomanasikara means the work of the mind which goes back to the source, the origin, the center of things. And that is the work of the mind which we're doing in this meditation practice. Instead of going onwards and outwards, we go inwards. And I mentioned that yesterday, the path of meditation, when we start going into time. In the center of the time, we have present moment. In the center of the present moment, you'll find there'll be this wonderful silence. Because in the center of now, there's no space to form a thought, to form a word. There's literally no time there. All you have is this one moment. In my little booklet, The Basic Method of Meditation, I gave the simile of you being a host of a party. And you're standing at the door of your house welcoming the guests. And there's such a stream of guests coming in that all you can do is to greet each guest in turn. But if you have a conversation with any one guest, you'll miss the guest coming in right behind. You can't afford to have a conversation with any guest because you have to attend to each guest as they come in. In the same way, when you are really in the present moment, you have to attend to every present moment, and the next one comes in just a moment afterwards, so you can't have a conversation with this moment. You can't even give it a name. All you can do is know this moment and let it go, so you can attend to the next moment. A knowing which is before words. A just knowing which doesn't try and categorize what you've just experienced. A knowing which experiences, doesn't name, doesn't work it out, but just lets go immediately. This is what we mean by the silence of the present moment. We're going deeper into the center of things. The words, the labels, are always on the outside of the package. The thing in itself is deep inside. And as we go into the thing in itself, we find that when we have present moment awareness and silence, the mind can still be aware of so many different things of the five sense world, especially sounds and feelings in the body. Though you have your eyes closed, usually you can't see things. Tastes and smells are usually not really active when one is meditating. But it's the feelings in the body and the sounds which are the things which are disturbing once you have subdued the thoughts. In order to go to the center of this thing we call body and mind, in other words, the mind inside, we have to go deep into our body. Going deep into our body means going deep into the breath. Instead of having many things to think about, just one, which is the breath. It's called focusing. It's making a transition from diversity to unity. Instead of having many things which you can be aware of, you choose one and you go into that. As you go into the breath, it's a long process to focus on the breathing. Simply because there's many distractions which you might have. Many of those distractions will not be sounds, because we're fortunate to be living in a reasonably, or practicing in a reasonably quiet corner of Colombo. I'm very impressed with just how quiet it is here. And it's also the feelings in the body may be a problem for you, because it's hard to sit for long periods of the day, but certainly when you first sit down, you're pretty comfortable. The biggest problem, again, is the thinking mind. So we have to try and subdue that by being more in the present moment, more right here, before words can even arrive. And as we do this, we do go into the breath. We don't need to call it even an in-breath or an out-breath, long or short. See if you can subdue that naming type of mind. And you can know without giving things a name. As an example of this, I want you to be aware right now of the feeling in your bottom against the chair or against the cushion. Can you notice a feeling in your bottom now? It's one of those feelings which in the English language we've never given a name to. So when you start knowing that feeling, you can't say anything. It hasn't got a language. And this is just an example. So much of life has never been given a name. There are many experiences which haven't got a label. And that's wonderful, because it shows that you can know something without saying anything about it. You're getting into the way of experience without naming. When you know how to do that, all this training which you've had in your schools and universities of always giving something a name, categorizing it, and then arguing about it afterwards is all put aside so you can simply know, simply, without giving anything a name. It gives us silent awareness. So when we're watching the breath, that's all we do. We watch the breath without giving it a name, without having a conversation about it. We just watch the breath and we go into it. So there should never come the question, what should I do next? That question is not permitted in meditation. The only question is, what am I doing now? Next should have no meaning for you. Only now is the only thing you can be aware of in this meditation. The next is just a fantasy. It's an illusion which creates craving, desire, and disturbs the tranquility of the mind. So instead, just now is all we need. So, not what we're doing next, it's what we're doing now. So you're just aware of what's happening. Not trying to drive the meditation onwards. This is what I meant by saying we don't meditate to achieve these jhanas, to get to them. We go inwards and find the rising side this moment. We unwrap the body and mind to see what's in the side. It's work of the mind which goes to the center of things. This is the only samana sikha. So we go into the breath, we just stay there. If you want to do anything, go deeper into what you're experiencing now. Know it more fully. To know it more fully, we're just more attentive to it. If I want to know this microphone more fully, I just watch it and allow my mind to center into it. And it's the nature of the mind to focus once you pay attention. There are many similes for this. The first simile comes from the Hindu tradition. And remember, there was no meditation in Hinduism before the time of the Buddha. In fact, there was no real Hinduism as such. There was the teachings of the Brahmins based on the Vedas. Very much a ritualistic type of practice. And the Buddha came along, found meditation, and made it so popular that later on the other traditions also included it. But this story from the later tradition of Hindu meditation is very apt. It's a beautiful little analogy. It's the story of the three students who were learning meditation through the art of archery. Having learned the basics of meditation, the teacher, their master, wanted to give them a test. So the master took a stuffed model of a bird, not a real bird, and he put it on a tree branch a long distance away. And then he told his three students that that was the target. And they thought that would be difficult to shoot at such a distance. But it would be impossible once they heard what the real target was. The real target was not anywhere in that bird. It had to be to the left eye of that bird. No other eye. Not to the head, not to the body, but just to the left eye. And they complained that was an impossible target to hit. But the master said, you can do this only if you focus on that target. To make yourself one with that left eye of the bird. And then, through focusing, through meditation, you'll find that you will be able to shoot the arrow through that eye. So with those instructions, he gave the bow and arrow to his first student, saying you can take as long as you like to focus on the target. But before you shoot, when you think you're focused, just give me a sign, I'd like to ask you a question. So the first student meditated for 30 minutes, focusing, concentrating his mind on the target. When he was ready to shoot, he gave the teacher a sign. And the teacher asked, can you see the bird on the tree? And the student said, yes, master. And the master frowned, pushed the student aside, grabbed the bow and arrow, said, you stupid student, go and learn some more meditation. First student had failed the test. And he gave the bow and arrow to the second student with the same instructions. Take your time. Meditate. Focus on the target. When you're one with the target, give me a sign. After 1 hour of meditation, the student gave the master a sign. And the master said, can you see the bird on the tree? The same question. And the student said, what tree, master? And the master began to smile. Can you see the bird? Oh yes, master. Stupid student, the master frowned, took the bow and arrow, pushed the student aside, and said, go and learn some more meditation with your friend. He gave the bow and arrow to the last student. You all know that in these stories there's always a three. We always do things in threes in Buddhism, whether it's a triple gem or Anicca-dukkha anatta. There's always three things in Buddhism. So this was a third student. And the third student was given the same instructions. Make your mind one with the target. Take your time. But before you shoot, give me a sign. 2 hours. That student focused on that target. Sweat was pouring off him. But after 2 hours, he gave the sign. Master said again, can you see the bird on the tree? What tree? Said the student. Said the master. Can you see the bird? What bird? Said the student. Ah,
said the master, please, what can you see, student? And the student said, all I can see, master, is one eyeball. Cool, awesome, said the master, because he was a modern day master. Awesome. Shoot. And of course, the arrow went through the only thing in the student's consciousness. Went right through the target, the eyeball of the bird. Now that is a beautiful story, which is why I like quoting it. Because when you focus, at first you can see many, many things. But if you keep your attention in the center, in the main thing, after a while, everything on the edge disappears. It's precisely the same when you watch a television. If you watch a small screen like I've seen on the back of the seats on the aircraft, or you watch a huge screen like one of these LCD TVs, this liquid crystal TVs, which are sometimes 3 or 4 feet, sometimes 6 feet wide, after a while, you find it's exactly the same experience. When you watch a TV, after a few seconds, the edges of the TV disappear from your consciousness. Just like when you're focusing on the eyeball of a bird. First the tree disappears, then the body disappears, then the head disappears, as you focus into the center of your field of attention. When you're watching the TV, it's the same. You may have a photograph of your marriage on the top. You may have the magazines underneath. After a while, you don't see them anymore. The same if you just focus on me. You won't see what's above me. You won't even see the sofa on which I'm sitting. But all you see is the center of your attention. But everything else falls off. When I told this story in November, in a retreat I gave in Perth, there was a couple there who thanked me because they planned to buy one of these big screen TVs. When I told them that actually when you watch it, it's exactly the same after a few seconds of being watching an ordinary small TV. And they were so pleased, they never bought that big screen TV, and they gave the difference as a donation to my retreat. I saved them some money. Because the only time the big screen TVs make a difference is when it's not turned on. Then it's impressive. But when it's turned on, you're watching it, it's exactly the same. You can test that out next time. You actually see a big screen TV and a small screen TV. The experience inside the mind is precisely the same. That's why it is a flaw, these people trying to sell these big screen TVs. But nevertheless, it impresses your visitors when they visit and it's not turned on. But the whole purpose of this particular simile is to show how focusing works. Whether it's a TV or the eye of a bird, what's in the center eventually is all you see. And what's on the edges disappears. So this is the way we focus on the breath. You can imagine like you're watching your breath go in and out. You can also feel your body. You can also hear sounds. It's like the body of the bird stands for your body. The sounds are like the tree. After a while of focusing on the breath, you can't hear the sounds anymore. Because what's in the center is all you can really see. After a while, you can't feel the body anymore. You can just feel the breath. Even the body of the bird disappears. You only see the eyeball. And this is a beautiful way of understanding the path of meditation. If you are watching the breath and you have some distraction, somebody coughs or somebody moves, or you can feel aches and pains in the body, don't center on that sound. Don't center on the feelings. Keep the mind centered on the breath like I'm focusing on you. I can't even see the other people anymore. They've disappeared. They've fallen off my screen. Center on your breath.
And if you have feelings in the body, they're on the edge of the screen somewhere. Any sounds of people moving or birds outside or dogs barking in traffic, they're on the edge. If you make them the most important thing, that stupid dog barking or my poor knee, if you put them into the center, then the breath falls off the screen. If you keep the breath in the middle, the most important part of your attention, then you find after a while, naturally, all the other distractions, feelings in the body, sounds outside, they will just fade away. You will not be able to hear them anymore. People again can do that very easily, say when watching the TV. Two of my disciples in Perth, you'd be pleased to know, they were Sri Lankan, they were Malaysian Chinese. They told me one day they were watching a movie on the TV. They didn't say what movie it was, but they obviously enjoyed it immensely. Because only after the movie had finished, they'd get up to make a cup of tea and go to the toilet, did they realize that some things were missing in their house. And even in the room in which they'd been sitting, right behind them, on the shelves, many things had vanished. They soon found out that a burglar had been in their house while they had been watching the TV. And the burglar was so cheeky, he'd actually come into the room while they were watching TV and stole things right behind their back. And they hadn't heard a thing or noticed anything because they were so caught up with the movie. They couldn't take their eyes. They didn't hear the burglar at all. They were very embarrassed. The burglar had been in the house while they had been there watching the TV, and the burglar just stole things from right behind them. I'm sure they could do that here in Sri Lanka as well. Especially if you're watching the cricket or something else important. You would be able to hear them. Now you can see what focusing is. Focusing is learning how to watch this moment called the breath. So you can't hear anything else or feel the body. You don't know the time or the moment just when you can't hear or you can't feel the rest of the body. It's just the process which happens gently. In the same way, when you're watching the TV, you can't see the moment when the screen, when the edge of the screen disappears. Sometimes I like to do this as a psychology experiment. To have different shaped TV sets, say a diamond set, or maybe a circular TV set, instead of the old rectangular ones. Just to prove the point that it doesn't matter what shape the TV is, after a while, when you watch the center, you can't notice the edges. They all appear the same inside. Because you focus in the middle. In the same way that when you're watching the breath, all you need to do is to make the breath the most important thing. The breath is what I'm going to watch. And the other things, you don't try to get rid of them. You don't try and push the thoughts, the sounds, or the feelings in the body away. You tolerate them. But only on the edge. And the center is always on the breath. You keep watching that center, watching the breath, keeping the breath in the center, the most important thing. And after a while, everything else just vanishes. You come to that stage, that's all you have in the mind, just the breath. You're going into the center of your five khandhas. Well, not the very center, but you're centering in. You've just got this beautiful breath and no other feelings in the body. When people get to that stage and just got the breath in mind, just watching the breath, please never think, what should I do next? You're doing the correct thing, well done, keep on going, don't change the attitude of mind, just keep focusing in, into this breath. There comes a time when you're focusing into the center of the breath that you can't know whether it's an inner breath or an out breath. There is another wonderful simile, and this time is from the Visuddhimagga, of the carpenter sawing a piece of wood. A carpenter has to pay attention to the saw cut. When the carpenter begins to saw, he can see the end of his saw blade and also the handle. And he probably can see the whole plank of wood. But you pay attention and focus in. After a while, you can't see the ends of the plank of wood. All you can see is just the few millimeters where he's cutting. And he can't even see the handle of his saw or the edge of his saw, the end of his saw. All he sees is two or three saw teeth. Just the ones which are touching the wood, the ones which are cutting at this moment. That's all he sees as he focuses in. And you can imagine that that carpenter, he does not know whether those saw teeth are at one end of the saw, or the middle of the saw, or the far end of the saw. You can't tell because all saw teeth, if you just look at them alone, look the same. And that's a wonderful symbol of what happens when you're watching the breath. After a while, you don't know whether what you're watching is the beginning of an in-breath, middle of an in-breath, end of an in-breath, whether it's beginning of an out-breath. You don't even know whether it's in or out-breath, it's just breath, that's all. Just like one tooth of a saw, they all look the same. At this stage, just even one moment of breath is indistinguishable from any other moment of breath. So if that happens, you don't know whether you're breathing in or breathing out, but you know the sensation, this is breath. That's all you need, and that's a good sign. It means you're focusing it even further. And it's not that far from just seeing this moment of breath to the whole breath disappearing. Now when we say the whole breath disappearing, sometimes people complain and say, isn't it so that in the Anapanasati Sutta you're supposed to be watching the breath? Is that okay not to watch the breath anymore? Well, actually, what's actually happening is you are still watching the breath. When the breath disappears, you are still watching the breath. But the reason it looks like it's disappearing is because you're watching it through a different sense base. You all know that in Buddhism there are six senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind is number six. What's occurring in this part of the meditation? It's the fifth sense base of physical touch. You've been using that to watch the breath, and now the breath has got so refined that nothing much has been changing because the breath looks the same every moment. That sense turns off. It's the nature, the physical nature of senses, that when things don't move and change, the brain turns off. You can't see or hear anymore unless it's changed. So because the breath is so smooth and unchanging, the sense of touch disappears. And what you're left with is the sixth sense of knowing, of mind. And this is how the mind knows the breathing, not how the body feels the breath, how the mind knows the breathing. It's exactly the same object, but dressed in a different garment. It's exactly the same as if you had a friend. A friend you've known for many years. A friend who had, say, a beard and hair. And they decided to go forth as a bhikkhu. And they had an ordination, but they never told you. And when you next see them, you see them with a brown robe, with no beard, with no hair. And you look at them and say, I know him. Do I? And you look up, oh yeah, that's, you know, whatever the name was. It takes a while to recognize someone when they're dressed in different robes, when they have a different hairstyle. It's exactly the same what happens with the breath. It's just appearing through a different sense door. After a while you recognize, oh yeah, that's my breath again. But it looks very different. It's what we call the mental breath. How the mind knows the breath is going in, going out. Actually, it's not going in, going out. No, it's breathing. And that mental breath is what you'll be aware of when you say the breath has disappeared. It hasn't disappeared. You're still breathing. You're just seeing it in a different way. So those of you who have the experience of breathing in, breathing out, and breath gets so refined, so still, and then you think it's disappeared. Just ask yourself, what's left? What am I aware of now? That feeling of peace and stillness, that is how the mind is seeing the breath. That's its main attributes. So you don't need to do anything. Just stay where you are.
and go deeper into that emptiness or whatever you think it is. As you go deeper in, right in the center there, somewhere, you'll see this thing we call the nimitta, this beautiful light which comes up in the mind. What that nimitta is a reflection of your mind. This is actually where you first come face to face with the citta, with the mind. Remember, the five senses have all been subdued now. They've calmed down. You're no longer seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, or touching. And the sixth sense, the mind, is dominant. When it's really dominant, you've gone so deep into these five senses, you see what I said, the emperor inside, the mind. And the reason why we usually see it as a beautiful light is because as human beings, the most dominant of our five senses is seeing. We spend more of our brain power on the visual sense than anything else. So because of that, because it's a dominant sense, when we see the mind through the mind door, that's the best analogy we can have to experience it as a light. But it is not a light, it is a pure mental object. But that is how it appears. When these things come up, never be afraid. Even though your body has disappeared, you're walking in the footsteps of the Arians, of the Buddha himself. If a light comes up, be still, be peaceful. Because when the light comes up, usually the first time it comes up, the people get so excited that it disappears straight away. And Ajahn Chah's famous simile of the still forest pool. It is the best analogy which I can give and share with you to show you why when nimittas come up, while they only last a second for the first time, and how you can solve that problem and stay with these beautiful lights for long periods of time. In the tradition of the monks of Northeast Thailand, after 5 years of basic training, we would be encouraged, sometimes even forced, to leave the monastery, to take our golden robes and a mosquito net and go walking and travelling through the villages and forests and mountains, either looking for other teachers to increase our knowledge of Dharma or finding places where we can practice meditation and solitude. Now in Sri Lanka we call it charaka. It was a strong part of our tradition. We had to do it after the first 5 years. So when Ajahn Chah, my teacher, would do his charaka, when you were wandering through the jungle, it was always very hot and dusty, and you would always try and find a river or a lake where you could wash, maybe rinse some robes, and get some water, filter some water for drinking. If you waited too late, you wouldn't find some water, so you'd have to meditate and go to sleep really dirty. It's always really uncomfortable, you know, to go to bed, you know, sweaty and dirty. So you'd usually in the mid-afternoon, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock, and start looking for some water. And once you had found that water and bathed and filled your water bottle, then you'd usually set up camp, put the mosquito up, not by the edge of the water, because that's where the animals would come out, but maybe about 10, 20 meters away. And then you'd meditate in peace all night. Or, as Ajahn Chah would often do, he would at night time just keep his eyes open and watch the animals come out to play. Apparently now you have like Discovery Channel or National Geographic Channel, where people delight in seeing the antics of animals playing, you know, naturally. Because animals, as you know in Sri Lanka, they can be very amusing to watch monkeys play. I remember once in a very remote monastery in the north of Thailand, I would put water out for the birds every evening so they can drink and wash. And I'd observe them through a knot hole in the wooden board of my hut. So I could see them and they couldn't see me. And every evening they would line up in a queue. I never realized that birds were so well organized. And they would take turns, and once the bird had finished, the next one in queue, there would actually be a line of them. And the next bird would actually come in and bathe and drink. And when he'd finished, the next one would come in. But every now and again, there would be one bird who would jump the queue. And all the other birds would pounce on him, feed him up, and he'd fly away. Even the birds had organizational skills. And they make sure, first come, first drink, first bathe. And it's wonderful to watch the antics of animals in the wild. So this is what Ajahn Chah would sometimes do. He'd keep his eyes open, but sit still, and watch the animals come out to play. They would drink, they would bathe, and they would sometimes fight or frolic like animals do, especially young ones. But he said they'd only come out to play when he was still. Because the animals are very scared of human beings. Usually the only humans they knew in the deep parts of the jungle were the hunters. And the hunters would kill them. And the animals didn't know the difference between a monk and a hunter. So if they saw there was a man there, they would run away. And even though they were thirsty, they would not come out. So the only way that the animals would come out was if Ajahn Chah was so still, he didn't move, and then they wouldn't know that there was a person there watching them. So he said they'd only come out to play when he sat very, very still. And then he could watch them come and play and enjoy themselves, and it was a wonderful entertainment for a monk who never had a TV or a radio or could go to the movies. But he said sometimes he was so still that when the ordinary animals had finished playing and drinking and bathing, he said some amazing, incredibly beautiful animals would come out from the jungle. Beings he never knew existed. Animals who were so rare that even his parents had never told him that such things existed. These were the weird and strange animals. And they were so rare because they were incredibly shy. They'd come out, look around and sniff the air. And if Ajahn Chah had moved slightly, they would have picked up his scent or his movement and would have run away and never come out again for weeks. They were that shy. But because he knew how to be still, those animals would come out, not realizing someone was watching, drink and play by the still forest pool. He enjoyed watching those very rare animals more than anything else. Now in that simile, those rare animals stand for the limiters and the jhanas. The still forest pool stands for your mind. Ajahn Chah stands for your mindfulness. It has to be still. If you are still long enough, the beautiful limiters and even the jhanas will come and play in your mind. But when they first come out, the limiter comes out from the jungle, it was, as it were, looking around to see if anyone is there watching. If you move, if you say wow, or scared, if you try and do something, if you move, the limiter knows, as it were, there's someone there, and will run away, and will hide, and won't come out again for weeks. Which is what happens when people have limiters for the first time. They move, and the limiter runs away again. You've got to watch that limiter with absolute stillness. You might be afraid, you may be excited, but suppress that. Just watch with stillness, not moving. And then that limiter will stay. I will entertain you and play with you and give you enormous happiness and joy, starting to get the bliss better than sex. And as you are even more still, that limiter will grow to such incredible power and beauty that you will find yourself merging and getting into the jhana. The jhanas too are stages of such amazing power and beauty, but that only happen if
you are absolutely still. Sometimes you have to coin new words. But very often the first time a person gets into a jhana, they come out immediately afterwards. It's what I've coined the word yo-yo jhanas. Because a yo-yo, the child's toy, which you may have seen, it's a piece of metal on the end of a string which is wound around it and goes up and down, up and down. That's what I call the yo-yo jhana. You go in, you come out again immediately. You don't stay down there. And the reason is because as soon as it occurs, you move. Like an Ajahn Chah, the jhana comes out of the forest. Wow. Even a small, wow. Jhana knows it and runs away again. That's called yo-yo jhana. You go in and come out immediately. And instead of doing things like that, we have to be so still. Still like a nature photographer. As still as a paparazzi. You know, one of my friends, he's married to a Thai girl. And he always comes to our temple. He calls himself a Buddhist. I think he is. But he is a photographer. And some years ago, there was the Australian singer Kylie Minogue, who's supposed to be world famous. She's a pop singer. And she was supposed to be, the report was that she had a nervous breakdown. And the rumor was she was holidaying in Cable Beach Resort in the north of Western Australia, outside of Broome. So he was sent out by his paper, just in case, to see if he could catch a photograph of this girl who was world famous. And he said it was one of the most exciting assignments of his career. As he crept through the bushes on the edge of this resort, and he managed actually to catch a photograph with his zoom camera of Kylie Minogue. And that photograph went all over the world. That made him temporarily well known and famous. He was a paparazzi photographer who got the shot which other people dream of. And he said he could only do that by remembering Ajahn Chah's still forest ball. Because he had to creep so silently. Because if she'd have seen there was a photographer there, she'd have run into a chalet and hid. So even there, I don't know whether it was a very good use of that simile, but even there, you can see the same skill as a paparazzi photographer. You have to be so silent, so still, to be able to creep up and take a photograph of the jhanas. Now that's the sort of thing which you need. The quietness and stillness. You can do that. The thing is, we forget, we don't remember. And that's why the first time these nimittas or jhanas happen, you're excited. So this again is going in. For those of you who ask what to do after you get the first jhana, again, that's not the right question. It's not what you're doing next. In fact, if you could ask that question, it's not the jhana anyway. You won't be able to move that much in the jhana. You're very, very still. But all you do in the jhanas, or rather all you not do, you just allow the whole thing to evolve, or rather involve, as you go deeper and deeper from one jhana to the next, quite naturally, without your control, just see what happens, and then afterwards you just come out again, according to the nature, not according to your schedules or what you want. And you've gone deep into the mind, deep into its nature. That is Yoni Samadhisika, always going in. You just see how deep you can go. The simile which I mentioned yesterday evening about the thousand petal lotus, seeing the jewel in the heart of that lotus, that again is also a very beautiful simile, because you're going into the lotus. You're going into this body and mind called your five khandhas, finding what's in its center. This is what one is supposed to be doing. Going in. Understanding that gives you the overall picture of what meditation is all about. We never try to attain to another stage. We don't go on to something. We don't give up what we're experiencing now. We go into it. Deeper and deeper and deeper into this moment. So don't be so concerned if you're sleepy or restless, having fantasies, head up, in pain or whatever. Don't try and get rid of that. Just try and find the center and go into that. And when you're in the center of the sleepiness, go into the center of the center. Go into the middle of time, go into the middle of silence, go into the middle like the archer watching the bird. That is Yoni Samanasika. And that's where you find the Dhamma, in the center of things, the origin, the law, where things come from. Where do you come from? Where does life come from? Where does delusion come from? Go into the origin of things. By going deep down. That's a part of meditation. Sometimes I get frustrated when people call this samatha, or they call it vipassana. It's just eightfold path. That's all it is. It's just a path of Dhamma. It's a gradual path. So don't try and divide this path into two, into three, into four, into six, or whatever. It's a unified path. So it always goes in. Goes in from diversity to unity. That's a part of meditation. So, has anyone got any questions about that? To give some feedback of what you're doing. Got any comments about that? Okay, while you're thinking, I'll mention something else. Another useful technique and supporting help for your meditation. The reason I talk like this and give many talks when we're doing a short retreat is because I know that what I say, even though you may not think you remember it or understand it, I know that that message has got inside your brain. It is heard, it is remembered, but subconsciously. What happens, you get to a certain stage in the meditation and you wonder what you should be doing, and the teachings which I've just given, then they will come to fruition. You'll understand why and what to do. And sometimes at the moment you may not realize that what you're doing is just remembering the teachings you heard earlier. So many of the things which I did, even after my teacher passed away, sometimes you'd be meditating, you'd come across a problem, and then you'd find a solution, and afterwards I'd reflect upon it. So did that come from me? I remember, no, Ajahn Chah taught me that years and years and years ago. It's as if that he was giving you all these gifts, but they were just waiting in your subconscious, waiting for the moment when they would become relevant. And at that time, they would be incredibly useful. So don't worry if you are just at the beginning stages of meditation and think that jhanas are so far in the future for me. It doesn't matter. The teachings have been put into your minds now. And at the right time, the right place, they will bear fruit. You'll get in them before. You won't know why, you probably won't even remember who told you it. But you'll do the right thing to get into the jhana. Simply because of what you've just heard. You can make use of this ability of conditioning in your meditation to avoid the problems which you encounter from time to time. We talk about hindrances, but of all the hindrances which are possible, there's always one which is your major hindrance. It might be sloth and torpor. It might be restlessness. It might be negativity or whatever else it is. Please identify your major hindrance. And then employ what I call the simile of the snake. Is it not the simile of the snake in the suttas? Is it that Ajahn Brahm's simile of the snake? Because in the first years of the forest monasteries in northeast Thailand, the monasteries were very poor. And very often I never had any sandals to wear. When they broke, and there was none left. So you just had to use your bare feet. Which was all right, except that in those forest monasteries, there were many things which regarded toes as so similar to worms
they thought that you were their dinner. Not only the snakes, but the centipedes, the scorpions, and the ants. There was a certain type of black ant, which when they bit you, you jumped, it hurt so much. So that we like having shoes to give us a little bit of protection. But even more so than the not having any shoes, very often there was no batteries for your flashlights. So there you were in the dark night, going back from the hall to your hut after the evening meeting, with no shoes and no flashlight, going walking through the jungle which had many, many types of snakes, centipedes, scorpions. And those snakes were all very dangerous, many cobras, many crakes, many animals which, if they bit you, would be in big trouble. And the only reason why I never got bitten was when I left the hall in the evening. I remembered there were snakes around. And because I knew there were snakes and they were waiting on the path, I was very, very careful. I was on the lookout throughout the whole journey from the hall to my hut, maybe 200, 300, 400 meters. So every time I saw what looked like a dark shape on the path, I couldn't make any distinction whether that was a shadow of a tree, a stick or a snake. I would either jump over it, or I'd go by another route. Most of those things would have been just shadows, but some of them would have been snakes. Because I was always on the lookout, because I was very alert for my dangers, I never got bitten. And I use that as a simile of a snake in meditation. Your major hindrance is like the snake waiting on the path for you, on the path to peace. So the beginning of the meditation, identify the danger. What stopped you getting into deep meditation so many times? Identify what is your snake. Understand its danger and keep a lookout for that danger throughout the whole path. It could be, say, sloth and torpor. I'm going to keep my eyes out for that. I'm not going to allow sloth and torpor. You're always watching for it. If you see sloth and torpor coming, you can take another route. Because sloth and torpor can be like that. It's like a fork in the road. You do have a choice if you can see the whole process of going on the path to sleepiness, on the path towards peace and alertness. So see what your snake is, your major hindrance. At the beginning of meditation, tell yourself, this is my major hindrance. I'm not going to get caught this time. I'm going to keep an alertness, aware of it. And if you set the mind up with that awareness in the beginning, you'll find you don't need to keep worrying about this. Just make the resolution. This is the hindrance I'm going to be aware of and avoid in this meditation. Make it very clear to yourself. Then forget about it and go meditating. You'll find you automatically set up a subconscious alarm system. And that hindrance is about to catch you. The alarm will sound. Hang on, here's something to overcome. And you'll avoid it. That is very, very effective when you get into the deeper states of meditation. For example, when, say, nibbata comes up, too often people get excited. After all this time, hey, I've got a nibbata, ow! And that wow response destroys the whole thing. So I tell many of my students who are getting into those areas of their meditation, when you start meditating, tell yourself, when a nibbata comes up, I will be still. When limiter comes up, I'll be still. When limiter comes up, I won't be excited. You repeat it to yourself 3 times, then forget about it. And just as the limiter is about to come up, only then does the program start to come up to what you programmed into your mind. Limiter comes up, and your old habit to get excited is stopped by someone who says, no, I'll be still. Brainwashing, conditioning, self-hypnosis, what I call programming your mindfulness. It works so well. It's a beautiful technique and overcoming the more difficult and sensitive obstacles to your meditation. So, what is your biggest difficulty in meditation? Remember that at the beginning of each meditation. And put a program in. Those of you who know computing, like a Norton antivirus, it's there in the system. But when some worm or something comes up, it bites the worm's head off. So your program never gets those viruses. This is actually how you do this. It's not Norton antivirus, it's just a Brown antivirus for meditation problems. So now, are there any comments or questions anyone has? When you have stillness of the mind, what happens to the memory? When you have the stillness of the mind for this process of meditation, your awareness gets stronger and stronger. As I said yesterday, and I hope you experience this truth, it's a fascinating part of Dhamma. The more still the mind is, the more energy it has. So your awareness is far greater than it is now. The awareness is so still, so powerful, so subtle, but it has more megawatts to it. And so because of that, the mindfulness has been empowered. Your memory is hugely increased. Another time when your mindfulness is empowered is when you're in great danger. If you're about to have a car accident, or if, like a robber, comes into your house and pulls a knife or a gun at you, or if the aircraft is about to crash, it doesn't matter how much someone has been sleeping before, or even if they've been drinking alcohol and they're a bit drunk, because of the danger, they become incredibly alert. So much so that after they've survived the crash or survived the trauma, they very often have to go to counselling to get rid of that memory. They can't forget it. It's called trauma. But in psychology, the only time we have such indelible memories is in the negative experiences. But when you have these still minds, you get the same quality of mindfulness, very clear and profound, without the negative effects and the positive effects, which means you can't forget those experiences. You don't want to, they're beautiful experiences. So anyone who's ever had a deep meditation experience, you will always be able to recall it. And even if you only had it when you were 14, no matter how old you are now, you'll always be able to tell people about it. Simply because it's the state of heightened mindfulness. The stronger the mindfulness, the more indelible it's put in your memory. I had a very good memory as a child in school. It's one of the reasons I did well at school and university. And because it's personal, I assume that everyone else had such a good memory. When it came to quizzes or examinations, I'd usually come, if not top, close to the top. And sometimes it was not just remembering the right answer, I could remember the time the teacher told me that. So my memory was very good. And I realised later on as a monk, it's because I had a very strong natural mindfulness. Basically, I paid attention. I was there when things were happening. I had an interest in what was occurring. And when you have that interest, you pay attention, you're energized. You do remember. Sometimes I have a whole catalogue of jokes. And sometimes it's, how do you remember all those jokes? That's another benefit of mindfulness. When you are very, very alert and mindful, then you have a whole memory of many, many jokes you can share with your friends to entertain them and bring some happiness into life. Because the latest joke I was telling many people, I don't think I've told this joke here yet, I've told it in Singapore to make people laugh. There was an Australian man, what we call the couch potato. You know that word, couch potato? Someone who just watches TV all day. And he was watching television all day on his armchair. And like Australians, they like their cans of beer. And so he had a whole bunch of beer on the table next to him. Many of the cans were already empty. And he'd been in front of his TV nearly all day. And he just watched a program on euthanasia. And he turned to his wife and said, "Darling, if ever you see me on an artificial life support, just on a liquid diet with no quality of life, please pull the plug." So his wife turned off the TV and he died. An artificial life support. No quality of life. So you can only remember jokes like that if you have white ones. If you're really alert, then you'll be able to repeat that joke almost word for word when you get home. You know what happens sometimes? I heard a really good joke, and then you start saying, "How did it go?" Because you haven't had mindfulness.
Yet. Donkey and the cat.
Donkey and the cat. I'll leave that for another day, because that's really on enlightenment, on insight. That's a very good story. The bottle joke. The bottle goes, yeah. That's actually a very good one to give at places like Mahavagama, when it's a talk to many, many thousands of people. But for those of you who don't know that one, that's, you know, because I'm not quite sure in Sri Lanka, but the Chinese people, and especially the Thais, they're terrified of ghosts. And I think it's the case is that when they were young children in the villages, the mothers would actually tell their children, "Don't go outside because a ghost will get you." And they use that to terrify their children, to make their children behave. And it's like a useful trick, you know, to make sure that don't go outside, the ghost will get you. And also the movies, which were especially in Thailand, and also Chinese movies, they'd also always have these terrifying ghosts. And they're like with the head, just with this bloody entrails trailing behind. No body, just guts. And the ghosts were always going to be eating people and just terrifying. So the movies made ghosts being very terrifying. So people grew up so afraid of ghosts. So we make use of people's fears to teach them how to keep the five precepts. So very often in Thailand and also in Singapore, Malaysia. And I also taught this when I was in Los Angeles at the temple in Los Angeles. I came along and told them that it's my duty to warn you of a very, very, very dangerous ghost which is causing a huge amount of problem all throughout the world. He said, "This is not a joke, this is a true story, because I've personally seen this ghost many times. It actually possesses people. I've seen many, many people possessed by this ghost. And as soon as they get possessed, they actually speak in a strange way. And they act completely out of character. It's not how they normally act or speak. And unfortunately, I've seen it so many times possess a person so badly, it causes their death. Many people have died because of this ghost. We call it the bottle ghost. And it's caused huge amounts of death. It's even caused many deaths here in Colombo, I'm sure. Although, you know, I haven't personally seen it here. It's called the bottle ghost, the most dangerous ghost in the whole world. And the bottle ghost lives in bottles of whiskey. As soon as you take the stopper off the top, it possesses you. And I've seen many people, once they've drunk a few glasses of whiskey, they act in a very strange way. And they speak in a way they don't normally speak. And I've seen many people drive and be killed by the bottle ghost. And that's why we call whiskey spirits." It possesses people.
found all the spirits to be afraid of. It's the ones who sleep in bottles of whiskey and wine and beer and whatever else. That's a bottle case.
So we use that. You can see the benefit of putting dhamma in modern ways. People tell that story. If you haven't heard it before, think, oh, this is interesting. Because we use the fear of ghosts to get people's attention. When we get to the punchline, it's not a lie because you can see the connection there with being possessed and say, yeah, it's true. And it makes a powerful point of the danger of drunkenness. And people always remember that. If you teach people with a smile, they always remember. If you teach people by scolding them, they will always forget.
So it's a very good little story of the bottle caps.
So you can tell, if you've got any husbands who keep getting possessed by the bottle ghost, you have to tell them, oh, well, there's a ghost which Ajahn Brahm was talking about. And then drag them along until they get to a certain point. And then you can give them the punchline. Okay, we can do some meditation now until 10 o'clock. And at 10 o'clock we'll have a cup of tea. And then having a cup of tea, those of you who are a bit stiff, you can do some walking meditation. And after the cup of tea at 10 o'clock, between 10:30 and 11:30, we can do some more meditation. At 11:30 we'll have dhāna. And those of you who are sleepy after dhāna, do some walking meditation if you need to, or have another cup of tea after lunch. And apparently from 1 till 2, you can have a dhamma discussion. But remember, a dhamma discussion means that you have to initiate some questions. So during lunch, now have a think to see what questions you would like to bring up for the dhamma discussion. So try to think of something controversial. Because the more controversial, the better. Now things like, can a woman become a Buddha? Or are there still arahats around in this world today? What else is that about? Who created the world? So get some nice controversial ones to ask. Okay, so then we're going to meditate till 10 o'clock. It's only 15 minutes. So remember, go inside the moment. Inside present moment, silence, breath. Always go in. And that way, is that the correct time? It's impossible. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. You can always go in. And that way, we get deeper meditation.